Well, have you ever heard the story about the manager of the electronics firm who had a big salary and was climbing the corporate ladder? Suddenly, he was called into the boss's office and accused of squandering the company's assets. "What's this I hear about your financial misconduct? You're finished here, so be out of the office by the end of the day," said the boss. Now, this once powerful manager was in a real dilemma. He had a big mortgage on his home, all kinds of things on credit, and little chance of landing another well-paying job. Agonizing over what to do, an idea suddenly dawned on him. "I know what I'll do when I'm finished here so that I'll have people wanting to welcome me into their businesses." Well, he quickly contacted the firm's biggest clients. He said to the first, "Now remind me again how much you owe us." "Oh, that much, eh? Well, I wanted to check, because as one of our biggest clients, you should be getting our wholesale price, about 30% less. So update your records with our wholesale price, send it in at the end of the day, by the end of the day, and have a good day." Well, he phoned up the next biggest client in the firm, whose wholesale price resulted in a nearly 25% savings. "Update your records with our wholesale price," he said. "Send it in by the end of the day, and have a good day." Well, by the end of the day, the firm's owner had gotten wind of his manager's creative accounting and shouted out to the manager as he paused just before heading out the door, "You're a real rascal, but you're also the most clever one I know. Others around here could learn a thing or two from you on how to turn good clients into good, really good friends." Now, the people in the office who saw and heard what had happened were kind of left scratching their heads, wondering what their boss expected them to learn from what they had just witnessed. Maybe you're wondering too. Well, it's amazing how Jesus' parables, with a little adapting and updating, are as engaging and perhaps confusing as ever. Perhaps you're not familiar with the parable of Jesus that I have in mind, or perhaps you would like to compare one that I told with the version of Jesus' original version. Either way, I think it would be wise to turn to Luke chapter 16. Luke 16, so that you can see and hear the story as Jesus told it and the lessons that he expected his listeners to draw from it. Now, the parable is only 8 verses, but there's some attachments to it, some applications, and we're going to read right to the end of verse 15. So, Luke chapter 16, beginning of verse 1. Now, Jesus told his disciples, "There was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, 'What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer.' Manager said to himself, 'What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do, so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses.' So he called in each one of the master's debtors. He asked the first, 'How much do you owe my master?' 900 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, 'Take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. Then he asked the second, 'And how much do you owe?' 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, 'Take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much, and whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No one can serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money." The Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. He said to them, You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of God, but God knows your hearts. What people value highly is detestable in God's sight. So, you've been asked by a new believer who has been reading their Bible, and they read this story and they say to you, could you tell me what the point of this parable is? And you say, Well, if you are still scratching your head over the point or points of the parable, you're not alone. After all, it seems to present a story of a manager who cheats his master and is commended by Jesus for being a liar and a thief. I mean, why would Jesus use an unscrupulous, dishonest cheat as the lead character in the story and then present him as a model for followers to learn a thing or two from? No wonder the parable has embarrassed Christians for centuries. Actually, in the 4th century, a man by the name of Julian the Apostate, that is, he left and abandoned the faith, he used this parable as his primary text, showing from it that Jesus taught his followers to be liars and thieves. And then Julian concluded, "Noble Romans, you should reject all such corrupting influences like this Jesus and his followers." No wonder this story has been called the most difficult of all of Jesus' parables. Now, it's not as if Jesus didn't tell other stories with unsavory characters. Remember the one that we looked at a number of weeks ago, where with this crooked judge who had to be badgered by the widow before he would do the right thing? Now, taking a closer look at that, we were able to distill the main points in that parable, but this one? I mean, how could Jesus use a crooked manager as a model for Jesus' followers, people of light, as he calls them in verse 8, to learn a thing or two from? Now, I need to tell you right up front that getting the point or points of this parable is going to take some work. Okay? But it's worth it. Okay? So with the Spirit's help, we're going to try to discern and decide what Jesus wanted and wants his followers to do as a result of it. Are you with me? Okay, let's go to it. Okay, to begin with, let's be clear about one thing. I do not think this parable was told to teach people how to use other people's money for their own advantage. Jesus does not condone embezzlement. The parable is not an encouragement to cook the books or indulge in creative accounting, as some call it. The manager in the story is not held up as a model for his business ethics or morals. So why use him at all? I can't say for sure. But it may well be that Jesus is picking up on a recent news item and adapting it in a creative and provocative way. Now, we know this is true in some of his other parables. There's actually a parable of the pounds in Luke chapter 19 about this interesting king. And we know from more historical study that that is a very much related to a story of how King Herod got himself into power and what he did for those who didn't follow him. So Jesus did that kind of thing. And Martin Luther, back in the 16th century, he wisely said, "Let us not fall into the error of imagining that everything in the story is significant." Or as one person said, "Parables were not intended to make them walk on all four legs." Okay? Often there's one point or a few points. Commentator David Ewart agreed, saying the story itself is part of the staging, the backdrop through which Jesus gives his followers instructions on how to view earthly possessions, wealth, and other gifts that God graciously gives us to manage. We should also take note of the audiences, plural, who heard it. Look at verse 1. And you'll see that Jesus was talking to his disciples, right? But a second audience is identified. That's why I read all the way to verse 14. The second audience is the Pharisees, right? And notice that both of Luke's descriptions of those Pharisees as lovers of money, as well as their reaction, sneering, they were obviously had disdain for Jesus' story and its point or points. So let's look at the story. Two main characters, the owner and his manager or steward. Now, in Jesus' home territory of Galilee, agriculture was the big business. That was the main economic driver. Wealthy landowners at this time were putting small farmers out of business by buying more and more land and then renting or leasing it out. And we're told up front that the landowner of our story was a rich man, a point backed up by the size of the debtor's accounts. 800 or 900 gallons of olive oil, that would take about 150 olive trees, a significant orchard in that day, everything hand done, and 1,000 bushels of wheat. Remember, this is just the lease or the rent amount on it. And that 1,000 bushels would need at least 100 acres. Again, all done by hand. These are significant amounts. He is a rich man. Now, we're not given any explicit info about this rich man. Was he good? Was he bad? Was he a tough negotiator? Now, a rich man like this, we know, needed a business manager, an oikonomos in Greek. And it was often either a salaried position or you were paid on commission. You get a percent of whatever business you do. Now, it was a prestigious position. But the business manager is accused of wasting or squandering his master's possession. We're going to come back to this later, but it's not a commonly used word, but it's exactly the same word used to describe the previous story of the prodigal son, what he did with squandering or wasting all of his possessions. Okay? Now, the owner's question is a classic opener. What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer. That is, it's an opportunity for him to come clean and to plead his case. Oh no, you've misunderstood here. Okay? The first surprise in the manager's story is his absolute silence. His silence is his acceptance of his dismissal. It underlines his guilt. There's no denial, no pleading, no challenging. Can you imagine? If you ever get your kids, you accuse your kids of doing something and you're wrong, they just take it silently, don't they? Never. 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 Okay? Kenneth Bailey, he's worked in the Middle East and taught there for over 40 years. He said, I've never seen dead silence when somebody is dismissed from their work. There's always denial or pleading or bargaining. The only thing we hear from the manager are the wheels turning in his head as he agonizes over this looming crisis in his life. As a manager, he had become accustomed, we would say, to a desk job. He knew his body couldn't handle hard labor, and he knew his pride couldn't handle begging. And he probably also knew that the people in his community wouldn't give handouts to an able-bodied person. His situation seemed hopeless until an idea came into his mind. He discovers, said Kenneth Bailey, that he has one last ace he can play with and daringly proceeds to play it. Remember, he was dismissed in private. He still has the account books in his possession, though not for long. If he is simply fired for corruption, no one will hire him. But if he can leverage his remaining ace, he can make friends with all the important clients. And then he might not only be able to survive the crisis, but even thrive as a result of it. His plan is creative, clever, shrewd. All of those are in this Greek word used. Each conversation he has is in private, without witnesses, and it takes advantage of what his debtors do not know and surely would not think to ask. Now, if a car salesman came and you were looking for, you're going back to your regular car salesman, okay? And he told you that he had negotiated a special agreement with a boss to offer a loyal customer like you the special employee discount. Would you object? Would you ask a lot of probing questions, or would you thank him and jump at the offer and then tell your friends about the amazing deal that you got down at the Jack's Auto? You see, it was a great offer with a credible explanation. Now, I know that some scholars suggest that the manager was not really being dishonest in his approach, that he simply gave up his own commission, okay, or that he canceled the interest on the debts the tenants owed. Could be, but it's all speculation. Now, the tenants would not have known that the manager was being terminated and no longer in a position of authority to be able to give them the wholesale price or the employee discount. And if you were one of the tenants, you would know it sounded like a great deal, but too good to be true? It seemed credible enough, and that's what the manager counted on. Now, of course, the boss could go to court after the fact and make the case that what his dismissed manager did was unauthorized, and he could force his debtors to pay the full price. But his reputation in the community would have taken a huge hit. You see, all of the good free press that he got from his best clients would suddenly turn into very bad press. Jack's Auto and the person who gave me this great discount would no longer be get raving reviews. It was like, would you know what that stinker did? Okay? And his boss, you know, put the squeeze. So going to court was financially expedient, but politically disastrous. He lived in this community. Or the owner could simply let his debtors keep their steal of a deal in this occasion and think he had authorized it. And he could pay the price, if you will, of this rascal's salvation, that is, getting himself out of this crisis. And he could continue to enjoy his reputation as a generous man, which had been enhanced by what this, you know, manager had done. And you know, the thing is that he was a generous man, the owner. One of the many surprises in the story is that although he dismissed his manager at the beginning, he did not jail him. Next week, we're going to look at a parable where people are in debt, and we're going to find the standard practice is to at least put him in jail, him and his family, or sell them into debt slavery to at least get whatever they can out of it, out of the losses. That's the normal. And he didn't do it. Nor did he try to sell them into slavery to recoup the losses. And it led him from taking otherwise normal actions and reactions that the manager seemed to have actually banked on. Remember the story of the prodigal son the previous week? Dave talked about that if the son went and said, "Dad, I want my inheritance now," what it was really saying in this culture is that, gosh, I wish you were dead and I could have what I really want. And nobody would dare say that. They would be in shock. And yet this son did it. Obviously, knowing his dad enough, dad might actually do that. He's kind of a softy. He's kind of generous. Well, in the light of this extraordinary grace, I think that he had already received, the manager had decided to risk everything in the roll of one dice. And the risk he took was built on the foundation of his master's generosity. And I think that helps us to understand the master's unexpected praise. And by that, this master can find something good even in a rascal and scoundrel, like the gracious father in the previous story could find something good in this prodigal son, each prodigal and wayward son. It's worth noting also the other striking similarities between these two stories. In Luke 15, the son throws himself on the mercy of the father, and in Luke 16, the manager throws himself on the mercy of his master. As Eugene Peterson notes, both son and manager are in desperate straits and have nothing to show for themselves except their wasted and misspent lives. One has made the mess of being a son, the other has made a mess of being a manager. Both son and manager betray a trust. The father and owner's possessions have been squandered, as I said before, the same Greek word. And neither one has anything to show for it. Neither of these scoundrels offers an excuse. They recognize what they have done is inexcusable. They do not get what they should have coming to them. They get grace instead. Amazing grace. And in both stories, there is no proper ending or resolution. We are not told in the previous story what the elder brother does. I think some of you asked Dave about that during the week. Nor are we told in this what happens to the manager. The missing ending clamors for a resolution. And we, the listeners, find ourselves drawn into the world of this story, a world of unexpected grace in which we're no longer just merely spectators, but suddenly we're drawn in, and now we're participants in this story. And we're left wondering, what will we do with the positions and possessions and powers our divine master has generously entrusted to us? Master, what should we do? What should I do to inherit eternal life? To have my story experience a dramatic turnaround and awesome outcome in this crisis? For I've blown it. When the great explorer and medical missionary to Africa, David Livingstone, died around the age of 60, his body was brought back home to London for burial. And one of his former classmates stood by the crowds that thronged the streets to watch the funeral procession go by for this great man. And as this colleague, the former classmate of his, saw the thousands of people who had come by, and he witnessed the passing of a great man who had given his life to save so many, this classmate was overheard to say, "I guess I put my emphasis in the wrong world." Imagine instead what David Livingstone experienced. Imagine coming home to glory and meeting friends from all over the world. Some people whom we may have never met in this life, but because of our creative and faithful stewardship of what God has given us, our time, our talents, our treasure, people heard the gospel. People received food and clothing. They got medical help. You know, in Luke, we have a kind of appendix attached to this parable in which Jesus spells out some of the important points on wise stewardship and how to avoid squandering and wasting our possessions and our lives, how to avoid being prodigal managers like the prodigal son was a prodigal. Now, it's generally true that people who are conscientious and faithful in little things will also be trustworthy when it comes to greater things. A while ago, our daughter Jessica lost her wallet. Someone turned it in a couple days later. Everything in it. Don't even know who it was. But if I find them, I'm going to think, wow, thank you for your integrity and honesty, right? I remember a number of years ago, our car got rear-ended and our car got written off. And I got called up a while later by the company where it was taken, and they were going through it. And one of the employees that was going through it found, you know, about $14 worth of change. Oh, I had forgot to take that stuff out of there. And he turned it in. So I went down there to collect my money and said, "I want you to thank that guy for that, and I want you to give him this money, because he certainly deserves it for his honesty." Faithful in little things, you got to think, man, you've got a good employee there, right? Honesty. We need to learn to give whatever it is when we earn a little. That's the only way that we'll be faithful if we earn a lot and much. Jesus includes not only the application, but the warning in verse 13, essentially telling us that the reign of the almighty dollar must be dethroned to make way for the reign of God. We must trade in an ownership mentality, and that's what we have. Even if we give, you know, a portion away to God, the rest is mine, right? Wrong. The Bible says the earth is the Lord's and some things in it. It says the earth is the Lord and everything in it. The part of the parable we should get is all of us are stewards of what God has given. None of us are owners until we get to heaven. Then we're told we're going to be owners, genuine. We're going to get part of the inheritance. The stewardship mentality will be totally different. And I'm going to show you a closing clip in a moment, because I think it brings together, we need shrewdness, creativity, cleverness, not dishonesty, but how to navigate, how do we leverage our positions, our influence, whatever possessions, for kingdom purposes, for kingdom ventures. Not just for our own retirement, but for the well-being of others. It takes creativity, and it takes a stewardship mentality. And there's a closing scene that I'm going to show you from the movie Schindler's List. Basically, the movie is the true story of a businessman and entrepreneur, Oskar Schindler, whose shrewd way of using his business during World War II saved over 1,000 Jewish people. For example, he didn't start out thinking, I'm going to use my business to save all these people. He first started, how can I still make money in the midst of the war? And there's things that happened along the way that turned that manager to apply what he did know and what he was good at to totally different outcomes. At one point, for example, Schindler expanded his factory so he could offer more jobs to Jewish people. And this was an absolutely unnecessary expansion, but it allowed him to save an additional 250 Jewish lives. And one of the closing scenes that takes place on the eve of the Nazis' defeat is there as Schindler is preparing to flee and his workers are gathering around him. And I think of Jesus' parable where he said, I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. If you could play that for us.
Hebrew from the Talmud, it says, whoever saves one life saves the world entire.
That's the image that Jesus wanted to leave in his parable for us of saying, what are you investing in? What are you investing in? Or are we squandering the time and talent and treasures that God has given us? Jesus said, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Amen. Let's pray.